places.
So that's going, you just...
Next on.
Okay, everybody, we're about to start the meeting. If you don't want to be in this meeting, go to the meeting you want to be in. Hi, my name is Liz. I'm an alcoholic.
Liz.
Hi, Liz.
Welcome to this open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Brighton Al-Anon Convention. Can I please ask you to ensure that your phone is turned off or onto silent? And now let's have a moment's quiet to gather our thoughts to remember the still suffering alcoholic, both inside and outside the rooms. Sam to read the preamble.
Hi everyone, my name is Sam, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Sam.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement of membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
This is an hour-long meeting, which closes at 1 p.m, with three speakers, each sharing for 10 to 15 minutes on a topic of their choice. There will then be time for sharing back from the floor. So it's my pleasure to hand over to our first speaker today, who is James.
It says AA on the note. AA.
It is AA.
I misspoke
it. It's AA.
Thanks, my name is James. I'm an alcoholic and great to be here. Thank you to Al-Anon for inviting AA participation. Thank you to the organisers of today. So I thought it might be useful to share about my recovery in AA and how it has affected the relationship with my family, because I started drinking at secondary school here in Brighton. And there was a pub in those days where you could get served underage. And my drinking progressively became more serious as time went on. And I left home at 17 with a massive resentment about everything. And what would happen was that I would visit my parents and my younger brother. And just feel so angry, because as far as I was concerned, the reason I was suffering the way I was suffering and the reason that I drank the way I drank was because specifically of my parents. I held them responsible. And I was trapped in that belief. So I would go to see my parents very begrudgingly and reluctantly, with a bad attitude, and I would take a litre of vodka with me, just in case there wasn't enough alcohol. Because when I went to see them, I was going to be drinking, and I had the attitude of what's my mother going to say next to upset me, and. Then I went to London, to university, then my drinking got more serious. I began drinking eventually every day. And to cut a very long story short, came into AA through a detox unit in Brighton, day patient unit, and straight away started taking the 12 steps. Found a sponsor, started going through the 12 steps. There's a lot in between coming in, starting drinking and coming into AA, but I wanted to just focus on how it affected my family. Got to step four. And at this point, started writing the inventory, step four inventory. And number one, resentment, was my mum. Number two was my father. What AA helped me to see was that I was trapped in a prison of believing I was a victim, that they were responsible for what had happened to me. And I saw that the problem, and specifically was my mum. You see, my dad had he had his own drink problem, so I kind of, by the time I got into AA, I was a bit more tolerant of him. Excuse me. But my mother, I absolutely held responsible. And what AA helped me to see was that the problem was not my mother. The problem was that I had a script, I had a demand, a set of demands, a blueprint of how my mother should have been for me to be okay. And she violated that script. She did not follow how I thought she should be, and that's why I was suffering. And AA helped me to see, working with a sponsor, going through the big book, nothing more than that. No secrets, nothing special, just going through what it says in the big book. Which is where, by the way, the instructions for the 12 steps are, if nobody's told you. Because it took a while for me to find that out. To see that the problem was my demands. And I don't know if you've ever tried to change anybody. I believe Al-Anon is big on like letting go of this thing of trying to change other people. Changing other people doesn't work. And even if they do change for a while, there's always the fear that they'll just go back to how they were before. So AA helped me to see that the demand that my mum should be different and the belief that somehow she was like going to be different was deluded. The problem was my demands. The problem was this script that I had. And it also helped me to take a step back and say, you know what, James? How would you have been as a parent, honestly? By the time I came into AA, whatsoever, I was 36. And if I was honest, at best, I would have been negligent, at best. Because I was, passing out on the floor, waking up fully clothed, having accidents in the street because of my drinking, became too frightened to go out because of my drinking, so I would drink at home. Became physically very unwell because of my drinking. There was not going to be, in all honesty, any time for kids. There certainly wasn't any time for anyone else, really, when I was drinking. And so the steps helped me to see that it was time for me to step down from the throne of judgment. It says in step three we had to quit playing God because it doesn't work. I had to step down from this throne of judgment that no one ever asked me to occupy and let go of this constant judging of my parents, particularly of my mother. Because I got to a point where I'd rather be at peace and happy than be right. While I'd been stuck in resentment, I was right, but I was incredibly unhappy, full of anger, and the relationship with my family really was entirely broken by the time I came to AA. For the first 6 months of my sobriety, I couldn't speak to my mum. I honestly thought, if I answer the phone, if she rings, I'm going to relapse. That was the sort of level of delusion going on. So, going through the step four and five process helped me to get free of this poison that I was carrying around with me and realise that it was time to forgive. It was time to forgive it was time to let go of who was right and who was wrong and realise that the higher power, I was going to have to ask the higher power to help me let go of the arguments, even if they were just in my head, to avoid retaliation and argument, even if it's just in my head, and see where I can be someone who is a member of my family rather than this, well, in all honesty, a drunken lush. That's what I was for a long time. I'd go see my mother, drink, pass out, get angry. There were times when, in blackout, I'd been aggressive towards my mum, verbally aggressive, I think quite frightening. And I'll tell you, I never ever once woke up in the morning and thought, now, how can I be frightened? How can I frighten my mum today? How can I be aggressive? But that's what happened on occasion by the end of the day because of my drinking. So, yeah, the step 4 and 5 process helped me to step free of being trapped in this I'm the victim of what they did thing. And then in step 9, the amends process really, I think, was one of the most powerful aspects of my recovery in relation to my family. Making amends to my mother, acknowledging what had happened, acknowledging that I'd frightened her, acknowledging and making amends for the fact I had robbed her of her peace of mind. When she worried about me when I'd been ended up in hospital or in a detox, and making amends also to my grandmother. By the time I got sober and was at step 9, my grandmother had dementia. I was like, how does that even work? How can I make amends to someone who's like suffering from dementia? And it was just a calm, quiet, peaceful conversation. She didn't need to worry anymore. All that drinking stuff was over. It was all okay now. My dad had left my family when I was about 17. I went to find him during the step 9 process because when I was a teenager, I'd stolen some money from him, that was all. And when I searched for him, I found that he died of alcoholism. And it was possible to make. The money was repaid to the hospital that cared for him at the end of his life. That's like a charitable trust thing. So the amends was made, even if it wasn't possible to make it direct. And yeah, with my stepdad, there was an amends, an acknowledgement, an amends for the way I behaved. And that was one of the ones I was quite nervous about, but actually he just shook my hand and said, you know, I feel the same as well. Let's start afresh. So once I'd completed the amends process, really it became possible to begin to be a son. The son that I had always really wanted to be, but I simply wasn't able to be. Because of primarily because of my alcoholism. The fact that I was trapped in this illness and couldn't see how it was possible to live sober. Like, couldn't see how it was possible to even to be with my family and to be sober. Didn't know how to do that. There's a bit in the big book, in the chapter about the family afterwards, and it talks about having an attitude of what can I give, what can I bring to the situation, to my family. Now, the stuff I've talked about so far was quite a long time ago. I'm now 11 and a half years sober because of AA, because of this program. And a few years ago, because of being in recovery, I got married. And I got married into a Jewish family. And let me tell you, Jewish weddings are different. Dancing in the synagogue is encouraged. So when we were planning our wedding, I asked the higher power, how can I bring my family, what can I give to my family? And I realised it was possible to include my family in this in a way that I'd never been able to before. So there was our mothers were lighting candles in the ceremony. There were a lot of blessings. My stepdad gave a blessing. My sister gave a blessing. My brother was doing, you know, really deliberately try to include my family. How can I bring spiritual principles into this? What spirit am I bringing to the ritual? The spirit of, yes, this is about us, but this is about us as a whole as well. And, you know, at the end of that day, my mother said to me, just quietly, she said, James, that was the happiest day of my life. That is AA. That is the higher power. That's what's available. Going from a place where I'm frightening my mum in blackout, aggressive, chucking beer bottles on the ground, to a place where she's able to genuinely feel that, be part of that, is you can't do that on your own. I could not have done that on my own. Without AA, without our 12 steps, I have no doubt I would have been dead by now. This program has saved my life. It saves many people's lives. If there's anybody new here, recovery is available, it's real, it's possible. That's what I've got. Thank you.
Thank you so much, James. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Helen.
Thank you. My name is Helen and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Helen.
It's really good to be here. And I was asked in preparing for this 10 or 15 minutes to look at the step 12 chapters of our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which I'm aware isn't Al-Anon approved literature. But it's the second part of step 12, really, in that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I try, and I emphasize try, to carry this message to another alcoholic and to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all my affairs. And those chapters, so I was encouraged to read, funnily enough, my sponsor suggested I read these chapters yesterday as well for a different reason, so it's all lining up. I was encouraged to read to wives, the family afterward, and to employers. And all three chapters deal with how to deal with the alcoholic. All the other chapters in our book, well, with the exception, one is written by a doctor, Dr. Silkworth, observing that doctors are not really able to help, not able to treat alcoholism, which is very relevant to my story. But all the other chapters of the book are mainly written by Bill Wilson, one of the co-founders. And they're the instructions for me as an alcoholic to take the steps and to continue to take my own inventory and to continue to pray and meditate. And then step 12 is all about working with others. But then to wives is from the perspective of somebody who's married to an alcoholic, and the family afterward is all about dealing with the, there is a word in it and I can't remember now, with kind of the newly sober, that's not the word, the head of the house actually is the word that's used, and it's assumed it's a man because of the time that it was written, but the head of the house. So that's all about kind of maybe using kid gloves, thinking you have to wrap them in cotton wool and dance around them and, you know, serve them endlessly, you know, and that kind of misconception. And then there's a chapter which I've always found really useful to employers, you know, written specifically. I don't think that was written by Bill Wilson. I think it was written by Hank Hurst, I could be wrong, or one of the big businessmen among the early members of AA. All the chapters weren't written by Bill Wilson. But it's from the perspective of somebody running a big business, and it was one of the first 100, running a big business, and how to help a potential alcoholic employee. So I read them all, and I found lots of principles. When I went through this part of the book with a sponsor, we pulled out all the spiritual do's and don'ts, regardless of what perspective it was written from. And the ones that always jump out at me were, actually the one I picked for today to make my theme, because I was asked to pick a theme, was we will forgive and try to forget. We would forgive and try to forget. Because I wasn't capable of that. before I started drinking and in early recovery, and until I'd worked the steps thoroughly, and I'm not capable of it if I don't work them every day. I am a real alcoholic, and I don't want a medal for that. It means that I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And I was struck recently reading the book with somebody, the number of times that hopeless and hopelessness is talked about. And that is so right, because I had no hope in my life. I grew up in alcoholism. My late mother, God love her, and we became the best of friends, which is why I say God love her and I smile fondly. She died during the pandemic, and I never imagined that she would die without me being with her, holding her hand, even during our most desperate, fierce, angry, violent, we were both quite violent, violent times. I still never imagined that I wouldn't be by her side, and I wasn't by her side as she was dying because it was during COVID. But there was nothing left to say really in terms of amends and love and friendship and companionship. You know, I still miss her an awful lot. But my emotion is also about the gratitude that I feel that I was able to forgive her, because I blamed her in my childhood for my dysfunction, because I was definitely very, you know, I don't even know what that word means really, but I couldn't, well, what it means for me was I couldn't function. The idea of sitting up here and speaking in front of you today would have had me on the toilet all night and been sick all night, because I stammered. I couldn't get to the end of a sentence without somebody finishing the sentence for me. So I was a very angry stammerer. You know, I hated the fact that people wouldn't let me. And either teachers would overdo it with me and, you know, exempt me from reading or speaking in public, or they would insist very cruelly and mercilessly that I had to sit up here and I had to perform and I had to read in class. And I resented both categories. That was a reality for me. By the time I picked up a drink at 17, I was never going to drink. I was never going to repeat the stuff that I'd seen in my childhood. And I did, but I didn't become violent and really dark until later on in my drinking. And it talks in our big book about it being cunning, baffling and powerful. And it was that for me, and it certainly is that living with an alcoholic as well. It was so unpredictable. And I never knew in those growing up days what I was going to come home to or what I was going to wake up to in the middle of the night. I was scared all the time. And I went on to repeat that, and I was very unpredictable. If I don't have a program today, if I'm not working a program today, I will be equally as unpredictable and as grumpy. I was just saying to James, you know, I hadn't planned on rain today, and I was grumpy when I came out of the station. You know, I dropped my big book dictionary, luckily not my big book, and I swore under my breath, or a little louder than that probably, and, you know, it wasn't my big book, but I might be the only copy of the big book that anyone sees, and that wouldn't be a great model for somebody seeing it. But anyway, as somebody sent me today, it's progress, not perfection. I don't use that as a get out of jail card, but I use it just to be a bit gentler with myself. I was very hard on myself growing up in alcoholism. I drank for 18 years not wanting to drink, so I really beat myself to a pulp about the fact that I couldn't stop. Despite my will being very strong in other ways, I could not stop drinking, no matter how I wanted. I mean, the insanity of that. I wanted from my first, I never wanted to drink. And from my first drink to my last, I was trying to stop. And believing it was willpower, believing there was something in here, you know, something deeply evil about me, that every time my mother drank, it was my fault. That was a big one for me. And that's why I need both fellowships today. I go to both, and I've taken the steps in both, because I work a lot with others. And that's the first part of step 12. You know, before I could work with others, I needed to take the 12 steps myself and be a good way through my amends to be set free. And I've taken the steps more than once, but I've only taken them twice exactly as they are in the book, because I've had a lot of sponsors. I have found that relationship quite difficult, and trust issues and And just bad behaviour, childish behaviour on my part, kind of trying to replicate, you sometimes acting out the relationship I had with my mother. And despite the work that I have done in AA, I can still do that with people. I can still find myself going back into old behaviours, and that's why I continue to take inventory, because I pushed down an awful lot of stuff in the years that before I drank, you know, because I was terrified to bring anything out into the open, the years when I drank. And I have to watch for this stuff daily. You know, our step 10 is, it's the same, isn't it? And both continue to take personal inventory when I'm wrong, promptly admitted it. But it talks in the big book on page 84 about watching, you know, really surveying, not just sort of passively going through my day thinking, oh, well, I swore, it doesn't really matter. No, I had to actually go and pause in the loo before I started here, because I couldn't find the venue then. And I was thinking, well, why don't they get a venue that's easier to find on Google Maps? So I had a bit of that going on. So I had to go into the loo and say my step 3 prayer, my step 7 prayer, my step 11 prayer, and read, I know it off by heart now, pages 84 to 88 in the big book. And then I was able to come out, and then I couldn't get my badge to go on the right way. So I thought, you know, something, you just need to stay close to God and be yourself and share your experience. You know, I'm here to share my experience of what the steps have done for me. And what they have done for me is, as what James said, was they set me free in that relationship with my mother, and they've allowed me to have a relationship with all my family members. They've allowed me to live in the same house for several years, and apart from one big row with neighbours, which I had to really work my programme on, to live in harmony. And that's a miracle as well. If I fought with people when I was drinking, I couldn't forgive, and I certainly couldn't forget. And I would be plotting and scheming around what I might do the next time, or what I might say the next time. My life was full of that. My childhood was full of that. The vengeance, the kind of talks in Al-Anon literature by tugging the rope in how Al-Anon works on the chapter, you know, about the family. And I used to tug the rope. I used to do it a lot with my mother. You know, just that passive aggression, if she'd say something, I'd say, ooh, that sarcasm. You know, we'd be back and forth with it. And I might forgive, but I wouldn't forget. And as a result, I would be kind of keeping it live within me, burying it alive, I heard someone say once. And through the process of the steps, my heart has opened. And I know today I can't afford to not forgive. And I have to forget, because if I don't forget, I'm not living in the moment. I'm not fully living, you know, I'm not fully doing step 3. To be relieved of that bondage, because the bondage in, you know, in our program, I think it's the Al-Anon step 3 is probably different, but it's the same principle of turning my will and my life over, my thinking and my actions. If I'm holding on to something somebody has done to me, and if I'm plotting revenge, even though not actively, I'm still in the bondage of self. I'm not free. I'm not free from that bondage, and I may drink again on that bondage. And then, you know, the remaining steps, you know, for a long time I just did inventory, because I liked actually talking about my life and I liked talking about the things that happened, but I didn't get free because there was no follow, thank you. There was no follow on to step 9, you know, between step 5 and 9, where I needed to have I needed to surrender those defects of character. I have to do that daily, as I've just told you. You know, I needed to make a list of people I harmed. I needed to make amends to them. I've approached everyone I've ever harmed. And now my task is not to gather up some new harms. I have a brother who's not very happy with me at the moment. He sent me 40 messages yesterday. So I have some work to do on that. I didn't reply unkindly. And I sent him a message this morning to wish him a good day and to say I was traveling, I'd be with some friends today, because I don't want another 40 today. But I don't want to pull the rug on that. I've had some people who would say, well, I will just block him. And I won't just block him, because I keep the door open. He's going through some very difficult stuff. I'm not giving him the answers that he wants, because I can't fix him, I can't cure him. But I can try and stay in his corner. I have some changes at work. They're not quite the way I want them either. So I like things to be a certain way. As James said, I like to live to a certain script, and I need other people to as well. But if I work this program, and I dug in this morning, I got up at 5 o'clock, I didn't sleep that well, because that stuff bothers me. And I did another step 4 just around it. My resentment with myself that these things are happening. And I did the first three columns, and I said, what is in our big book is a sick man prayer. And I will let that percolate for me today, and I'll do the fourth column later on or in the morning, because I want to be free. And I'll talk to my sponsor then, you know, about what I find. And I'll do from 4 to 9 on that, because if somebody's sending me 40 messages of something not quite right in my life, I believe. I'm not responsible for other people's behaviour, but there may be something I've done or not done that has aggravated that. I can't just say, oh, block him, just leave him, you know, he's a sick person. Yeah, but I'm here to be of maximum service to everyone that I can be in my life. And I keep trying until I can't try anymore. And I haven't had any situation where I can't try anymore. Sometimes with sponsees, if they don't want to work with me, you know, I have to do it kindly and encourage them to work with someone else. But I'm here to be there for whoever I can. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Hi everybody, my name's Sean, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Sean.
Thank you all for being here today, and thanks for the committee asking me to come along and share a little bit of my story with you guys today. And, I was thinking on the way up here what sort of a message to bring to an Al-Anon convention and an AA, and I guess the, you know, I'm the child of an alcoholic, and grew up in an alcoholic household. And my mum was, some of you will know, was a very keen, active member of Al-Anon for many years. And as children, we started Alatini's in Brighton and Hove. And we used to go along as teenagers, myself and my siblings, because we were allowed to smoke there with this other adult, and go along and moan about our dad, what a bastard he was. Our father, he came to AA when I was 12 years old in 1978, and for us as a family, that's when the crazy shit started, was when he stopped drinking. He also suffered from bipolar, and that really, really came to a head. And he came back from a meeting one Sunday, and he flushed his bipolar medication down the toilet, because allegedly somebody had told him at the AA meeting that he wasn't sober if he was taking this medication. And I don't know if that was true or not, but he stopped taking the medication that he was being prescribed. And from then on, until he died last month, we've just had to deal with this absolute nutcase at times. And thank God my mum had Al-Anon to help her through those difficult times. And there's a bit in our book, it talks about a farmer coming up from the cellar after the tornado has gone past, saying, "Gee, Ma, ain't it great? The wind stopped blowing, you know, and the farm's gone." And you know, in AA, we talk about putting the drink down to just the beginning, you know. And there's 12 steps. It's about working on ourselves, and if we don't change, we stay the same. And you know, my dad, he died 45 years without a drink, but he never took a step. He would sit in meetings, and you would think he was like the soberest person in the room because he had the longest time, but he was a nightmare to live with, you know. And the irony is that people are often in AA, they talk about not wanting to become the drunk of their alcoholic parent, you know, and doing that. And for me, it was like I didn't want to be sober like this man, you know. When he was drinking, he was a pub drinker. There wasn't he didn't drink much at home. He loved being in the pub, and of course in them days the pubs closed at various different times. And he was a handful when he was out drinking, with the fighting and smashing places up and getting arrested. But we never really had that at home. He'd come home a bit contrary and fall asleep, you know. He didn't smash our house up. I never seen him raise his hand to our mum. He'd just be a bit contrary. But once he started coming to AA and not drinking, we would wait to hear when he came in from an AA meeting, the sound of the key in the door, to depend on what sort of a mood he was. And this is a man without a drink inside him. And then we'd scatter to stay out of his way because we didn't want to get in the firing line. And this was somebody that wasn't drinking. He's like mad, you know, like, and that's what they talk about is the untreated alcoholism, you know. And so I used to read the big book. The big book was at home, and I'd pick it up and I'd read the bits and pieces in it, and I'd read this thing. It talks about the allergy to alcohol. It's like, if you take one drink, you know, you want to have another one. And I remember reading it thinking, you know, of course you do. Like, that's what happens when you have a drink, you know. Like, I mean, that happens to me, and I'm not an alcoholic, you know. And I really thought that with the knowledge of reading the book and the experience of growing up with somebody drinking, that I would be able to somehow manage my drinking or stop my drinking before things got that bad, you know. And my mum, bless her, she used to leave little Al-Anon leaflets by my bed at home when I was 15. And there was what, it was like these cartoon little pamphlets, and mum was, who, me? The teenage alcoholic, right? And I'd be on my bedside table, I'd be like, oh, fucking hell. And I'd tip it down the side and the back, and then when I'd come back, it'd be back up there again, you know, like, this went on for years. For years. And anyway, I came to AA for the first time in 1999, as you know, and saying I was an alcoholic. And that was when wife number one had kicked me out. And you know, the irony about it is that I'd said to her, I will stop drinking and I'll go to AA, and she said, I don't need to do that because I'm not putting up with the shit that your mum puts up with, right, with your dad. This is a sort of example about thing, and I'm not bad-mouthing him now because he's not here, you know, to defend himself. I'm telling you the truth. And I came to AA in 1999, but I continued to use other substances, just not drinking, trying to get back with my wife. And when that wasn't apparent, you know, like the bit to wives in the book, oh God, like it just, oh, poor daddy, he's trying to do really well, head of the house, all that, oh, you'll be nice to him, and I remember leaving that book to wives open at the house for my wife to read with some poems I've written about, you know, like, and that, you know, I'm a sick person, and if I have cancer, you know, like, and so, and I drove and went out for a little drive for an appropriate amount of time, and I thought, you know, I'll go back, she'll be reading this book, she'll realise that I'm sick, she'll give me a big hug, she'll say, we'll get through this together, you poor thing, you know, like, and everything will be great, you know. And I arrived back and there were bin bags outside the front door with all my stuff in. I think, oh, this isn't going according to plan. And went there, and anyway, she got my poetry and the big book, threw it at me. She said, I really don't care what you do, just don't come back, you know. And I was kind of relieved, I was gasping for a drink. And then I embarked on 5 years of, I would drink till I had to stop, and then I would stop till I had to start. But I was never going to come back to AA with all you nutcases. And I remember one time my mum said to me, in her little Irish accent, she said, would you not think about going back to AA, Sean? And I went, oh, mum, it's all full of fucking nutters there. And she didn't argue with me. She just was like, yeah. See, we never really had much experience of meeting people that were not drinking, going to AA and happy. You know, like, there were only people we met were drinking, not going to AA, and mad or angry. You know, and the people that my dad would bring home, they either relapsed or got well enough to realise that he was quite unwell and distanced himself from him. So I found myself back in AA by accident in 2004. And I met people that were coming here doing this stuff, and they were happy. And I couldn't believe it, you know, that they were, you could be unhappy. And they were doing this stuff that we talk about here, the 12 steps. They changed, you know, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted something different for my children than what I grew up with. And I'll give you an example. My dad passed away last month, and for your Al-Anons in here and those in AA, the difference between just not drinking and working this 12-step program and living this way of life. When I was about 10 years old, I used to stay with a friend of mine on a Saturday night, and on a Sunday, with Irish Catholic family, his parents would take me to church at St. Joseph's in Elm Grove, 6 o'clock mass, and I would meet my dad there, and then I would go home with him from church. And when we pulled up outside the church this particular Sunday, his car was parked outside the Admiral Napier pub, and he was asleep in the car with the window open. And my friend's parents were like, "There's your dad there, he's asleep." And I tried to wake him up, and I couldn't wake him up, and I was worried about him. And the window was open, and I thought, he's gonna get robbed. So they went into church, and I said, "I'm gonna wake you with my dad." And he woke up, you know, about half an hour later. And he must have been, I would imagine that he was embarrassed about what happened. But what he did, like a good mad paddy, was he beat the shit out of me and told me off for not going to church, right? And it was like, "I was just worried about you." And a couple of years ago, I was taking him to, he was like 43 years sober and kept going to lots of AA meetings. And I was taking him to a doctor's appointment at the top of Elm Grove at the Brighton General. And when we were driving up, we went past the pub, and it reminded me of, you know, what had happened. And when we were coming back down, I thought, "Do you know what, I'm gonna say it to him." And he said, "Oh, there's one of my old haunts there." I said, "Dad, do you remember that time when you fell asleep?" And I told him the story of what happened. And I've been in AA for a long time by this stage. And was just saying to him, you know, "And I was worried about you." He said, "What did I do?" I said, "Well, you beat the shit out of me for not going to Mass." And he laughed and he said, "Well, you should have gone to Mass then." And I just thought, what a waste. What a waste. Have you learned nothing in 43 years of sitting in those rooms? That's the best you could come up with. After 43 years of being in these rooms and hearing about the stuff that we do here to be different, that's your answer. I went home and said to my wife, "He will never, ever change. He will never, ever change, you know, to do that." And, you know, he passed away last month, and just before he died, I had to get his will from the house. He was in hospital, and he very kindly left me out of the will, and for these erroneous reasons. And it was absolutely heartbreaking, but not necessarily because of that, because what he'd said to the solicitors was that he had let me out because I'd stolen a family business from him, and he hadn't forgiven me. Thank you. He hadn't forgiven me, and we didn't have a relationship. And I presented him with this, and I was so glad I was able to do it. And I said, "Dad, this is like really hurtful because we've never not had a relationship. I was the only one looking after him. The rest of my siblings lived abroad. And I've been looking after him since Mum passed away." And I was able to say to him, you know, like, "This is just not true, you know, and it's so hurtful." Thank God we were able to change it before he died. We were able to put that right. But he spent 10 weeks in hospital from when he went in to when he didn't come out. And in that 10 weeks, he just sat there telling me about every bastard that had fucked him over the last 50 years. And I just was like, "Have you not got anything nice to say about anybody?" And all I take from it is, what a waste. What a waste of this stuff. What a waste of sobriety. You know, there is so much more to not drinking, you know, to sobriety than just not drinking. And I just hope that I can break that cycle and that I have a different relationship with my four lovely children, you know. And one of the things I strive for is that my children won't be scared of me. And I think I'm succeeding because they don't take a fucking blind bit of notice of anything I say. Like, they've got no, they're not like, you know, tidy your room, do that, and they're just like, whatever. So I think I've succeeded in that, you know, area. But I've celebrated 20 years of continuous sobriety this year, and it's not been easy. You know, we've had a lot of difficult stuff to deal with, and that's really when this stuff comes into its own. When you're cruising around and you're driving a nice car and you've got a few quid in the bank, it's very easy to be grateful for this program. But when somebody dies and things go a bit awry, that's when I found that this stuff really, really works, you know. And I was going to get some t-shirts done, you know, when the tough gets going, the tough start praying, you know. And I found for me that that's been an incredibly powerful tool. And my life today is incredible as a result of coming here. Unbelievable. Far exceeds my expectations of how I imagined my life would be before I fell into the depths of alcoholism and drug addiction. But I have four wonderful children today, a wonderful wife who I met in AA. My eldest children, they don't remember their dad drinking. And our youngest two children have never seen their mum or dad pick up a drink. And we have a wonderful, happy household. And that's all I ever really wanted, you know. And I got all that because I came to AA and I tried to practice the stuff that's talked about in here. And I'm very grateful for that. Thank you all.
Thank you, Sean, for your share. So we now